Welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 276 for August 29th, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
What we'd like to say publicly is I used to do some practical experiments with distilling. And finally, when the people became very interested in what those experiments were producing, I decided that I might turn it into actually a legitimate adventure.
That's Jess Graber, the founder and master distiller of Stranahan's Colorado Whiskey. Jess was one of the distillers on hand the other night at the Whiskey Guild's Whiskey on the Hudson cruise in New York City. I'll have some of the evening's highlights with a special focus on the micro distillers. That's coming up later, along with the calendar of events, the emails of the week, the What I'm Tasting This Week department, and an update on the Water of Life Drive. First, though, let's look at the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie. And in the interests of transparency, I'd be leading with this story even if Glenmorangie was not a sponsor. There is a new addition to the Glenmorangie Private Reserve Collection. Fine Alta is said to be distilled from a recipe the distillery was using back in 1903, and that recipe includes peat. That's right, a peated Glenmorangie. Fine Alta is being bottled at 46% ABV, and it'll be available in European travel retail stores starting in September. However, it will be available in North American retail markets starting early next year. That was not included in the original Glenmorangie news release, but the U.S. division of Glenmorangie owner LVMH has confirmed it. I've had a chance to taste Fine Alta, and I'll have tasting notes for it later in this episode. Another duty-free expression coming out, the Macallan is adding to its 1824 collection series with Oscuro. It's a very dark sherry cask matured whiskey. Ken Greer will tell us more about that in a few minutes. The revived Glenglassaugh Distillery is still a little while away from releasing its first official single malt since reopening, but is going back to its past for a series of new bottlings. The Manager's Legacy series will honor the work of former distillery managers at Glenglassaugh between 1964 and the distillery's closing in 1986. Release number one comes from Jim Cryle's tenure, just 200 numbered bottles from a refill sherry hogshead that was filled back in 1974 when Jim was running the distillery in his pre-Glenlivet days. Glenglassaugh has also released more of its young spirit for whiskey lovers to taste. The Spirit Drink series includes Clirac, new make spirit that was originally known as the spirit that dare not speak its name when it was first released. Blushes is the new label for the spirit that blushes to speak its name, six-month-old spirit aged in ex-wine casks. The new additions are Fledgling XB, 12-month-old spirit from ex-bourbon casks, and Peated, new make distilled from peated barley. That one's obvious. Plans are to release a three-pack of Clirac, Blushes, and Fledgling XB this fall. Ben Riach is celebrating its sixth anniversary under the ownership group led by Billy Walker and is releasing 10 new single cask bottlings to mark the occasion. All 10 are bottled at cask strength and range in age from 17 to 33 years old, with a mix of wine finishes and what Ben Riach is calling classic Speyside casks. There's one unusual cask in the batch, a 30-year-old Ben Riach distilled in 1980 and aged in new American oak. I mentioned the new Bal Blair 2000 vintage a couple of weeks ago. There's also a new 1978 vintage, both slated for European sales only. Bal Blair is also sponsoring a new series of jazz concerts in the UK, Paris, and New York City. Looking to Ireland for a moment, I mentioned the Irishman's annual cask strength release back in April. Got word from Bernard Walsh at the Irishman this week that 600 bottles have just arrived in the U.S. for retailers. And there's a new Irish whiskey that I discovered just the other night. Slievefoy is an 8-year-old Irish whiskey distilled at Cooley exclusively for the Price Imports division of Anchor Brewing and Distilling in the U.S. I tasted it the other night, and you'll be able to find my tasting notes for it on the Whiskey Cast website and in the Whiskey Cast iPhone app sponsored by the Glenrothes. Now, every August at its Whiskey Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, the gang at Royal Mile Whiskies asks people to vote on the whiskies they're tasting. The winner of this year's Spirit of Whiskey Fringe 2010 was the Bunahavan 25-year-old, followed by Old Pulteney 17, the Caledonian 1965 Clandenny, Glenmorangie 16, and the Brooklady 17-year-old rum cask. Rounding out the top 10, Brooke Laddie's 3-year-old quadruple distilled X4 Plus 3, the Balvenie 17-year-old Madeira cask, the 1979 Port Ellen Old and Rare, Springbank 18, and Glenfarclas 40-year-old. Finally, when I talked with Richard Patterson of White & Mackay last month, we briefly talked about plans to celebrate his 40th anniversary in the whiskey business next month. Turns out there's a variation on the flash mob called a tash mob planned for Whiskey Live Glasgow, with a bunch of people planning to show up wearing fake Richard-like mustaches. And there's a competition for people who can't make it to Glasgow. The best photo posted online this week with a fake mustache will win a bottle of White & Mackay 40-year-old scotch. You can enter at Richard's Master Blender blog, and there's a link at the WhiskeyCast website. And that's the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie, handcrafted by the 16 men of Tane since 1843. Let's update the Water of Life drive now. First Time is running out to bid on the case of 6 signed bottles of the upcoming limited edition Amrut single malt. David Finkel still has the high bid of $1,200. The deadline to bid is midnight Tuesday, New York time on the 31st. Meanwhile, the Water of Life online drive stands at $2,351, still about halfway to the goal of $5,000 to give a village of 250 people clean drinking water for 20 years. Donations fell off a bit this week. If you've already made a donation, thank you for your support. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit this address, mycharitywater.org/whiskeycast, or just click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website. Now, the Macallan's Sir Purdue decanter, filled with 64-year-old Macallan, will be displayed in Taipei and Shanghai over the next few weeks on its world tour leading to the auction in New York City on November 15th. I talked with Ken Greer, the director of malts for Edrington Group, about this special decanter this week. Ken, we've talked a lot about the Sir Purdue decanter as it's made its way around the world so far this year. How did this idea come up with the Macallan?
The idea came up, Mark, when we had the privilege of inviting Silvio Dents, who owns Lalique, and his team up to Macallan. We've had a very, very good relationship with that particular group for a number of years now. They have helped us produce some extraordinary decanters, of which there are now 3 in number, the 6 Pillars decanters. We had a great conversation with Silvio. He very kindly took me through all the high craft elements of his particular business. And one of the things that we talked about were some of the extraordinary craft developments that they've been involved in over the years. One of those was what he described as Sir Purdue, or lost wax. Now, that was last used by Lalique 80 years ago, and they stopped using it when René Lalique himself became too arthritic to use the process. So I said to Silvio, hey, that sounds really, really interesting. Do you think we could make a special one-off piece? And he said, sure. He said, but of course, you'd need a very special Macallan to go into that. And I said, well, we might just have something there, because I knew we had some extraordinary 64-year-old liquid. And that's how it all came about. Very often, as normal, it's, you know, over a dram, and it's sitting in our cottage, and it's the way we like to do our business, just chatting with our friends.
And that's the way a lot of good ideas happen, is sitting down talking over a dram, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think single malt is one of the greatest blessings on earth, and you know, working with Macallan at Highland Park, I'm very privileged to be able to drink some exceptional single malts, and that's probably where some of these crazy ideas come from.
Now, how did you get Charity Water involved?
Well, the idea really blossomed from that, Mark, as these things do. It kind of grows a bit like Topsy, just got bigger and bigger. And we got the guys going on this fabulous decanter, and they have some amazing craftsmen. So we produced this gorgeous piece. We said we wanted something which looked as though it came from the 1820s, so inspired by that. So we came up with this idea of a ship's decanter. So very wide base, so it wouldn't rock on board a ship. Extraordinary carving of the River Spey, of barley, of oak trees, all surmounted by East Rocky's house in Macallan in the Stopper. So we kind of had that, and we began to burnish that idea and say, well, this thing is too beautiful for us to put in a glass case. We then had the idea of maybe we took it around the world and displayed it to people, and then we suddenly had the bright idea, well, do you know what? Why don't we do some good with this? And the idea spawned from there into saying, well, let's think of some areas which really are non-denominational, non-partisan, right across boundaries, important to everyone in the world. And that's where we came up with the idea of linking to a water charity. Because wherever you are in the world, everybody wants everybody else to be able to enjoy pure, clean, fresh water. And that's where it started. So we approached Scott Harrison and the guys at Charity Water. They were very, very keen and have been extraordinarily helpful. They're an amazing organization. They've provided fresh water for well over a million people worldwide now. And we said, okay, what we'll do is we'll hold a great auction in November of this year, which we will do on the 15th of November in New York City at Sotheby's. And any of your listeners can bid if they would like to. Just get in touch with us at McCallum. We'll tell them how. And effectively within that, we said, gosh, we're going to sell this. And we initially said, well, you know, we'll give some of the proceeds to Charity Water. And then we said, you know, we're not going to do that. We're going to give it all away because these guys deserve it because we're so impressed by the great job they do. And it only takes about $5,000 to build a well and for a whole village to have fresh water. And that's how the idea started. We then said at each of the individual events, and already we've held events in Paris on the 150th anniversary of René Lalique's birth, in London, in Madrid, in Hong Kong, and in Seoul. And currently that decanter is actually in Taipei. And we said, do you know, we could actually give some lucky individuals the chance to preview that product. So we said, okay, you can bid for a 10cl sample, your snifter of the 64-year-old liquid. And we've been lucky enough that we've raised $44,000 through that so far, enough to build almost 9 wells, which is amazing.
And that's a really impressive thing. And you still have more ways to go on this because I know it's in Taipei right now, as you say, and then it's going to Shanghai also in September, right?
Yeah, the schedule that comes up is, as you so rightly said, is Taipei, then moving on to Shanghai, and then we'll go to Tokyo, Osaka, we'll be in Singapore, and we then go to Beverly Hills, and then we end up in New York City in the middle of November. So as we raise money along the way, and we're looking for more ways for people to contribute, and all this money goes to charity, there's nothing in this from the McCallum other than a nice warm feeling of goodwill. And, you know, hopefully we can manage to double that total that we've got so far. And then, you know, it would be absolutely fantastic if somebody dug deeply and owned this phenomenal piece. Because, you know what, Mark? A great piece like this sold for almost $300,000 just 2 years ago, a great Sierra Perdue piece from them. So, you know, we'd be looking to get something, you know, pretty high in terms of, you know, a fee for this, because all of this is going to a great and worthy cause.
And that one piece wasn't filled with whiskey, was it?
Absolutely. You know, you've kind of got the cherry in the cake here, you know, with our oldest ever McCallum, 64 years old, you know, rich, resonance, sherried, indulgent. It's a fabulous dram.
And we should talk about that because this is actually the oldest McCallum ever bottled, right?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. This combination of two casks, as I say, 64 years in maturation. So it is indeed the oldest product we've ever had, and we thought we needed to do something extraordinary for this particular product. So that's kind of where we are, and I would just like to say a big, big vote of thanks to your good self and Whiskey Cast, and to all your generous listeners who have actually contributed, because I know that you're actually saying to people, contribute, you know, a mere $10. Tip that in, and I think you're up to over $2,300 already. And wouldn't it be fantastic over the next couple of weeks to have a Whiskey Cast well?
That is my dream. That is why I'm following up on the suggestion that you made originally back in April to see if we could do something to help out in this project. And it really is going to be a lot of fun, and I hope we can pull this off. I'm confident we can do it, if not by the end of September, much sooner than that. We're only about halfway there. Now, Ken, while I've got you on the line, what else is going on with McCallum that we should talk about? Because I know you were doing some stuff down in Spain recently as a sequel to the Rankin project, right?
Yeah, well, we always believe in not only making some fantastic whiskies, but we also believe in actually producing beautiful things that, you know, people out there who love whiskey, who love fine art, who love just the finest things in life can get involved in. Now, we had just a phenomenal success with the Rankin project. I mean, we generated over $4 million worth of PR. We produced 1,000 beautiful objects, which are pretty much all sold out now. And, you know, we had a lot of fun doing that. what we've done since then is we said, gosh, how do we actually do something that's even different from that? Because the Masters of Photography theme I'm very passionate about and will go on for many years. We said we'd like to work with Albert Watson, who is one of the top 20 all-time great photographers. A Scot originally, but been living in New York City for about 30 years. A guy who has shot over 240 covers of Rolling Stone magazine and Vogue. Shot some of those famous movie posters, whether it's Kill Bill or Memoirs of a Geisha, shot guys like Hitchcock, Mick Jagger, whoever, great guy. So we said to Albert, okay, we would love to work with you on the sequel to the Rankin Project. What would your art concept be? And he came up with a really cool idea of a very art noir, filmic, kind of romantic road trip, which follows the journey of the McCallan Wood. Because remember, 60% of the flavor of our single malt comes from the quality of the wooden casks. And we buy 90% of the Spanish oak cherry cask used in the industry, paying about five times more for them because they're just better. And we followed, Albert followed us from the north of Spain and the forests of Galicia, Asturias and Cantabria, with this very romantic journey of this couple. They're probably just honeymooners who stumble across our sawmill in the forest. They then follow that wood curiously to our cooperage down in Jerez, to the bodegas of Spain, where we season the cask for dry Larosa sherry, through to Scotland, seeking out this fabled place called McCallan, and eventually to the distillery itself. So we shot some extraordinary images. We're currently working on putting those into quite a unique new product, into a fabulous, fabulous whiskey, with some great images packaged with it and a superb exhibition. And you'll hear more of that later on in the fall. And of course, we will have an event in the US and you will have the pleasure of being able to see those great shots. So quite excited about that. Different from the Rankin Project entirely, but quite exciting. And on the product side of things, we've had some really interesting snippets this week. Firstly, we have launched a new product into duty-free under our 1824 collection, a range of great whiskies that take the best of our casks and use them just when they're at their peak of perfection. We produced a product called Oscuro, O-S-C-U-R-O. This will sell for about $500 a bottle. It's 100% first fill sherry casks, and it is one of the richest, darkest, most indulgent products we've ever produced, so it's an absolute barnstormer. A couple of other things, any of your listeners that were lucky enough to buy a Burns 200th anniversary bottling from us, believe it or not, for a product that we produced and sold for about $300, it sold for about $1,700 at auction at McTeers this week. So any of you lucky enough to have one of those will have seen their investment rise. Some of the other stuff that's happening at the minute are we, for the first time, became the leader in the Asian duty-free market, which is quite an achievement. Just after us becoming number two in the US this year. So we're having some good success and a lot more folks are enjoying our product. And we just go on trying to produce some great scotch and hope that people like yourself and your listeners enjoy it.
You can get details on how to bid on the decanter at the McAllen's website. And again, you can support the Water of Life Drive at mycharitywater.org/whiskeycast. Let's check the emails of the week now. Brought to you by Highland Park. David Finkel of Philadelphia, again the high bidder in the Omrod auction, but he also had a question for me this week, too, that I'd like to share with you. Here's the question. I recently purchased 3 2.5-liter oak casks that I intend to first fill with a wine, and then after 6 months or so, empty the wine and fill the casks with 10-year-old cask-strength Laphroaig. The obvious objective, and I know this is nothing new or novel, is to see if I can finish the Laphroaig, creating a successful expression. Where I need your advice is, what wines do you think might lead to the most successful result? Well, this is something I have not tried myself, so I have no experience with it, but I know there are plenty of experimenters in the Whiskey Cast audience. What wines do you think would complement a cask-strength Laphroaig? Email me your suggestions, I'll pass them along to David, and here on an upcoming episode. Personally, I'd love to try it in a Cabernet Sauvignon cask. I think the strength of the cab might hold up well with the Laphroaig, but I could be wrong on that one. Had some more feedback on the ringtone that Tom Ollie has produced from the Phase Isle series of podcasts. Both Ivo Finati and Bruce Barr reported problems downloading the iPhone version of the ringtone from the WhiskeyCast website. Guys, I'm sorry you had trouble. For some reason, that version is not downloading properly, but since iTunes can make MP3 files work as ringtones. I've pulled down the iPhone version, and I'll suggest you use the MP3 file instead. Also got an email from Aaron Silverman at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's U.S. chapter. The fall series of Single Malt Extravaganzas starts on October 7th in Chicago and runs through December. WhiskeyCast listeners can get two tickets at the Society members' price of $120 each. Just use the discount code WC10 at the Society's website to get that special price. Now, if you have a question or a suggestion, just email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and the emails of the week are brought to you by Highland Park. Just click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website to join Highland Park's inner circle. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. There's a Maker's 46 launch party Tuesday night the 31st at Village Whiskey in Philadelphia. Kensington Wine Market in Calgary will hold an Aaron tasting on Thursday the 2nd. Binney's in the Chicago suburb of Naperville will have a Scotch tasting on Friday night the 3rd. And the Binney's stores in Lakeview and downtown Chicago will hold Whistlepig Rye tastings with Dave Pickerel on the 7th and 8th. This coming weekend is a busy one. Maltstock in the Netherlands, the Köpenicker Whiskey Herbst in Berlin, and Whiskey Messen in Copenhagen. Whiskey Live Glasgow is September 11th. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 14th through the 19th. Richard Patterson will teach a class on blending whiskies at Milroy's of Soho in London on the 20th. I'll be in Paris for Whiskey Live the weekend of September 25th and 26th. VIP tickets are sold out, but there are still regular tickets available. I'll have special shows from Paris that weekend. Those are just some of the events in what is shaping up to be a great September for whiskey lovers all over the world. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Just click the Laphroaig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. There were dozens of great whiskeys being poured the other night at the Whiskey Guild's annual Whiskey on the Hudson cruise. In addition to the mainstream whiskeys you'd expect to find, there was the Glenmorangie Finalta and the Sleeve Foy I mentioned earlier. Maker's 46 made its New York Festival debut on the cruise, along with several new Brookladdies and the Usquebaugh blended whiskeys. A few weeks ago, we heard about Sam Simmons' plans for a special Balvenie room on the boat for Warehouse 24 Club members. I spent some time that night in the room with Sam.
We talked a few weeks ago about this year's peated cask, 17-year-old, but there was one we missed and didn't talk about, right, Sam?
Yeah, there's another new release we have coming, a new 14-year-old, actually. Some whiskey geeks like myself might have noted that there was for a while we had a 14-year-old Cuban cask in France. In 2006, we had a rum wood. We have golden cask in travel retail. Rum is something David Stewart thinks goes really well with Balvenie. That sweet honey note really pulls out when you add a bit of rum cask. So he's been experimenting with different ones, and he's used a Caribbean rum to treat American oak casks that he then put 14-year-old Balvenie into to make this new 14-year-old Caribbean cask, coming to the U.S. and Canada only.
But this is a permanent addition to the North American range, right?
Yeah, it'll be a standard. It'll be a part of the range. It'll sit price-wise probably right between the 12-year-old double wood and the 15-year-old single barrel.
And as you mentioned, this is something David's done a lot of experiments with, both at Balvenie and also across the street over at Glenfiddich too, right?
Yeah, sure, exactly. Well, especially with rum, right? So the famous one is using that Havana Reserve when he did the 21-year-old Glenfiddich that was matured in Cuban cask. That was obviously a bit of a problem in the USA. So he definitely enjoys using rum with most of the whiskeys that he works with. I think it really complements Balvenie especially well.
You got a promotion too, I hear.
Yeah, the word is traveling. So yeah, the family and colleagues have invited me to be the global brand ambassador for the Balvenie, and I'm still a bit stunned, and I can barely put the sentence together for you here. But it is it's a great honor. It's still sinking in.
Are you going to move to Scotland or stay in New York?
I think what I need to do is go make whiskey. So I'm going to go to a few different countries, actually, and work at different distilleries before getting back to Balvenie. I worked there for a bit, and to get back there and work there again, to be in the still house, to be in the turning barley, and be be in the cooperage with the lads. I think that's something I need to do just to, first of all, get away from Manhattan and get an opposite lifestyle for a bit, and just to reconnect with what we're doing at the distillery.
Now I'm nosing this Caribbean cask. It's got this nice sweet note to it, obviously, from the rum. But what else sets this apart?
For me, the Doublewood is, you know, the enterprise. It's the leader of our fleet, really. And flavor-wise, that's big, rich, sherry-style whiskey at 12 years old. As we step to the 15-year-old, you get to a more delicate single-barrel type of whiskey. So this 14-year-old sits right in there flavor-wise. It's delicate, sweet, goes very well with tobacco for people who enjoy cigars, because all those sweet notes are all there. But it doesn't have the weight of the sherried Doublewood. It's really a different step altogether, both from the single barrel and from the Doublewood.
I'm getting some nice tropical fruit notes, a little bit of mango, some notes like that in there too.
Yeah, candied fruits as well. I smelled banana, mango, ginger. When you're swallowing it now, I found that when I let some air in after I swallowed, ginger sort of spiciness, really mellow, really easy drinking. And we've had a lot of people tried already who weren't whiskey drinkers say how much they loved it. So we're excited about that. You know, you always want to get more people involved in whiskey. And, you know, I've been a whiskey evangelist for almost 10 years now. And the more people we can convert to this club of ours, the happier we'll all be.
By the way, it's going to take two Balvenie guys to replace Sam as U.S. brand ambassadors. Andrew Weir will handle the eastern half of the country, while Nick Palacci has left his PR job at the Edrington Group to become the West Coast Balvenie ambassador. Congratulations again to all three. Of course, the Balvenie is owned by William Grant & Sons, and its new cousin was at the other end of the deck. Grant's and Tuthilltown Spirits announced an alliance earlier this year, and Gabe Lorenzo of Tuthilltown is all smiles.
It sort of allowed us to leapfrog ahead of where we were organically growing and sort of create a niche for ourselves as a New York State distillery and build up our own distillery with the support of an amazing family-owned company like William Grant. We now have the infrastructure for engineering, for distillation, for marketing and distribution, and for financing when necessary. So.
And you didn't sell the distillery itself, you just sold the Hudson brand, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Tuttletown remains independent, micro-craft distillery, and we're still continuing to produce all of Hudson spirits, all the Hudson whiskeys, on-site at Tuttletown. So we separated the IP of Hudson, sold that, maintain a production contract to continue producing with William Grant, and are able to focus on whiskey production and building out our distillery. So.
And it leaves you the ability to make your own whiskey for the future, right?
That's absolutely right, yeah. For the foreseeable future, we'll only be making, marketing, and selling Hudson whiskeys, but we do have the ability to put away our own whiskeys, and who knows what will come out after the partnership.
Now, who decides what you're going to come out with, William Grant or you and your father?
We've got a core line of five whiskeys that are part of the Hudson line, which have been sold to Grant. So that's what we're going to be making for them. Anything else that we want to make on the side, we can do. And if they decide that they want to pick it up, they can. So we can continue to experiment on site and play around. But the core five whiskeys under the Hudson line will be continue being made.
And this was sort of a problem that a lot of small craft distillers face, is the inability to really have in-house engineering experience, the financial backing, the legal backing, and that sort of back office infrastructure that Grants gives you now, right?
Yeah, I mean, people don't realize that every single penny that comes into the distillery up until now has been gone right back into the distillery, and nobody is getting paychecks. You know, although our brand was widely received and successful, it was still very organic growth, and this sort of just secures our future and allows us to focus on making whiskey and have that infrastructure of engineers and centuries of distilling experience behind us to solve problems when they arise.
And before that, you didn't have that. If you had a problem, you had to figure it out yourselves, right?
Which we did a great job of doing, but this is going to be a lot more efficient, yeah.
Tuttletown is the first U.S. micro distiller to join forces with one of the major distillers. And the micro distilling community was well represented on the cruise. Rick Wassman had the latest versions of his Wassman's Rye and Single Malt from his Copper Fox Distillery in Virginia. And a new Virginia distillery turned some heads. Catoctin Creek is located in Annandale, Virginia, about an hour outside of Washington, D.C., and is producing 100% organic rye whiskeys, along with gins and brandies. Scott Harris and his wife own and run the distillery.
Our rye mash bill is 100% rye, so we're not diluting that flavor that you get with rye with things like corn and wheat.
So how did the distillery come to be?
You know, it's funny. My wife is a chemical engineer, and I am, by trade, a government contractor. And we just got to a point where we decided, you know what, we're not getting any younger, and what do we really want to do with the rest of our careers? And so we decided to start this distillery. We've always been great lovers of spirits, and so we just decided, what the hell, let's open a distillery.
Tell me about the process you went through to get to the point where you're at a New York City festival displaying your whiskeys.
Yeah, we basically spent a whole year developing the business. So we were in the doldrums of the economic meltdown, and I was busy putting together a business plan. And for an entire year, we basically built that, and we're seeking capital and getting everything ready, buying equipment. And at about January of 2010, so just this year, we turned on the still for the first time, and we started to run production. So the whiskeys that you're tasting here are our very first year's production.
What have you learned about this process?
There is an awful lot of work cleaning up. We spend so much time cleaning up. And I tell you what, you know, making the stuff, once you have the equipment, once we have our methods down, making the stuff is actually really pretty straightforward. It's not too hard. We do the same thing every day, day in, day out. The difficulty for this business is being a small craft brand like we are is marketing. You know, we just can't compete with the big guys for attention sometimes. And so we've got to make a product that's a lot nicer and a lot smoother. And that's where we picked, you know, organic grains. We're true believers that organic makes a truly bitter spirit. And so we're trying to produce a spirit that just tastes really, really good.
Where did you get your distilling experience from, though?
It's funny. We had a lot of experience with, there's various courses that you can take. We've been on courses in Chicago. We've had distillers come to Virginia and help us learn the craft. You do a little bit of tinkering here and there. But essentially, it was sort of self-taught.
Where do you hope to take this to over the next 5-10 years?
You know, in 5 or 10 years, I mean, we really want to be a really solid regional brand. So we want to stay, you know, our core area right now is around the D.C. metro area. It'd be nice to be sort of an Atlantic Coast spirit and be recognized in this area. Now, I say that, we just got into Northern California. So, you know, I guess we'll take the orders where they come. But it'd be nice to just have a few states under our belt, maybe 10 or 12, and just have a really solid following from there.
Now you're selling both aged and unaged, and the aged isn't that aged, right?
Yeah, no, the aged is pretty young as well. So the unaged is extremely smooth, and because it's so smooth, we don't need a lot of time in the barrel to pull out the impurities and a lot of the sort of rough edges that may be in a raw spirit. And so we're really only aging for a few months to get the flavor we want from the wood and the color we want from the wood.
Now, one of the things I'm noticing here, because I'm looking at both of your bottles, and obviously the unaged, the Mosby spirit, is pure clear rye whiskey, but just after a few months in barrel, this has this nice little almost coppery tone to it.
Yeah, it's incredible. That's one thing, you know, we've done a lot of experiments with different grains, different fruits in the barrel, and there is something in the DNA of rye that just wants to be in wood. It pulls color out of wood faster than anything. We aged barley, wheat, we've aged pear and grape, and all of those spirits took twice and four times as long to develop the color that the rye gets in a few months.
Where do you source your wood from?
All of our barrels come from a Minnesota cooperage. It's 100% Minnesota white oak. So handmade, you know, the way they've done it for hundreds of years.
What's the name of the cooperage?
It's Barrel Mill, Richard Hobbs.
And for those of you who are listening, you may remember Little Richard was a sponsor of Whiskey Cast back in December during the holidays. And I'm hoping that's where you heard about him, but I'm assuming that's not the case.
We heard about him through the trade. We've got some trade references and stuff, so that's where we got them. They're great guys.
And you're using essentially new Minnesota oak as opposed to the Kentucky oak and the used bourbon barrels that a lot of folks do. What does that new wood give you?
You know, the new wood, well, that's one of the other advantages of new wood is that there's a lot of wood to be gotten out of the first run in that barrel, you know. The older barrels have become a bit depleted. You know, the whiskey takes with it the wonderful stuff from the wood. This wood ages very fast.
Are you having fun?
Oh, we're having a blast. Never had more fun in our life. We're working hard, you know, 20 hours sometimes on the weekends, but it's great. We're having a great time.
I don't have formal tasting notes on them, but Scott's Rye were very impressive for being so young. Now, it may take a few years, but Catoctin Creek might just be able to follow the precedent set by one of the most successful U.S. microdistillers. Jess Graber started bottling his Stranahan's Colorado whiskey back in 2006, and his whiskey is now in such demand around the world that Jess had to move into a new distillery last year.
The new Stranahan's distillery is a blessing for us. We moved in there last May of 2009, and it allowed us to continue producing what we've always done, but increase our production. So it's been very fortunate for us.
How much capacity were you able to increase it by?
We were able, at our old Blake Street location, we were able to make about 6 barrels a week, and in our new location, we're able to make up to 18 barrels a week.
So you're able to actually try to start meeting this demand in a few years, right?
We're hoping that we're still feeling a lot of love in a couple of years, and all the whiskey we produce is going to be sold out then as well.
Are you surprised by what has become a really global reaction to your whiskey? Because I have seen various blog comments and posts from Europe and all over the world commenting about how good Stranahan's is.
We just feel that we're very fortunate that people have tried our product, and we do the best to put our quality into it. And it's ultimately, if what's in the bottle is good enough, the consumer will enjoy it and embrace it. And we just feel fortunate that people have liked the whiskey.
Now, tell me how you got started in this altogether.
Well, that's a real long story, but what we like to say publicly is I used to do some practical experiments with distilling. And finally, when the people became very interested in what those experiments were producing, I decided that I might turn it into actually a legitimate adventure.
We'll not refer to terms of moonshine or anything like that.
I am unfamiliar with those words.
But how did it come about that you went from essentially those practical experiments to becoming a commercial distiller with global distribution?
Well, a lot of it is working pretty hard. You know, you got to pedal a bicycle as fast as you can, as often as you can, and experimenting with the recipe that we thought would be worthy. The original goal was not to make someone else's scotch or make someone else's bourbon, but make something that was distinctly from the Rocky Mountains. And so we worked real hard on that, and you know, just be a slave to quality. Make sure that whatever goes into the barrel and then it's going to come out and go into the bottle is the best that you can possibly do.
You're selling whiskey that's between 2 and 5 years old and 5 years at the max. And in the whiskey world, that's regarded as relatively young. What about the climate in the Denver area and the terroir makes it that you can actually make good whiskey at less than 5 years of age?
The first step is having really high quality ingredients and then doing a fermentation purification process where the actual wash that we distill is purer than most other distillers have to deal with. So we've got a really clean distillate to begin with. And then our barrels at altitude react to high and low pressure dramatically, and that helps force the whiskey in and out of the wood. And so that combination of pure distillate and whiskey being moved in and out of the wood by the headspace in the barrel creates a very good tasting whiskey at what's considered to be a young age.
We had this discussion earlier tonight before the interview, and I've always wondered about the effects of altitude on fermentation and on maturation of whiskey. What have you been able to find with Denver being literally at a mile high above sea level?
Well, I think the most dramatic thing is when the altitude, when you fill a barrel and a whiskey soaks into the wood, there becomes an air space at the top of the barrel known as the head space. So the whiskey soaked into the wood. As you get a high pressure moving into the Rocky Mountains and the barometric pressure goes up way high, that's going to expand that head space and force a whiskey into the wood. All of a sudden you get a storm coming through and the barometric pressure drops, that headspace decreases and the whiskey falls back out of the wood. So that it's like a sponge, squeezing and releasing a sponge, the altitude, we think, helps mature the whiskey at a rapid rate because it's moving in and out of the wood cells.
And your warehouses are climate controlled, as we've discussed before.
That's correct. It's hot in the winter, and it's really hot in the summer, and it's humidified. So the cells of the wood stay open because they're humid and they're warm, and that way the whiskey can go in and out of the cells of the wood easier.
How is your whiskey changing as it gets older?
We think it's getting better. We are still going to have our final combination is still going to be 2 to 5 years in there. We think that some of our fresh two-year-old whiskey is really have some really good cereal qualities to it, and the older stuff takes on some oak, and we want to maintain that combination. That's the kind of whiskey that we're trying to make.
What's the oldest whiskey you have in your warehouse right now?
The oldest whiskey is we start decanting it at 5 years. We actually take it out of the barrels. The whiskey actually almost starts to turn black after it's been in there under our conditions of aging after 5 years. So we decant that, we put it into stainless, and then we start mixing that in with our batches. So each batch is going to contain some 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-old whiskeys in it, and we think that that adds to some of the complexity of the flavor.
You having fun?
Beats working for a living.
Well, you're traveling around a lot doing these shows and everything, but what's it like at the distillery on a day-to-day basis?
I have some amazing people working for me right now. Jake Norris, our head distillery, is in charge of production. We've got a really good crew. They're self-managed. We've got now people where we're doing regular tours that they come in, and I really think I see the smiles on their faces. They show up and they enjoy the job, and they understand that they're creating something in the world that is highly regarded, and there's a lot of pride in the distillery. They're happy to be there working.
Where did the Stranahan's name come from? Because you could have called it Graber's.
Well, Graber's not really a good name for whiskey. Stranahan came from George Stranahan, who started the Flying Dog Brewery. And when we first started making whiskey, we hired Flying Dog to make our whiskey mash for us. And they did it through their beer process, which once again removes the impurities. And George has a hell of a good sound of name for a whiskey, much better than Graber. And he supported the distillery from day one and made our mash for us. So it was a logical conclusion that his name should go on the bottle.
You ever think you might release one with Graber on it just for fun?
Not if I want to sell it.
You ever thought about doing a limited edition version or a cask strength?
We're constantly experimenting with doing some different kinds of releases. The problem for us is we're so limited in what we can do that anything that we try or experiment with, we're only going to be able to sell out of the distillery because the quantity we produce is not enough to spread it around the world. So we're trying not to make enemies by saying, we have this, but you can't get it.
By the way, the odds are you'll never see this on a bottle of Stranahan's. It's actually a single malt American whiskey. Jess isn't big on fancy terms like single malt. Now, why don't we start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with a look at Stranahan's. It's bottled at 47% ABV. The nose is spicy, oaky, and intense, as you'd expect for a young whiskey. Notes of apricots, vanilla, and a subtle touch of molasses, too. The taste has a peppery bite on the tip of the tongue, good malty notes, and a subtle sweetness of caramel, cola, and brown sugar that continues through the finish. It's very smooth and balanced for such a young whiskey. I'm scoring Stranahan's an 84. Now, the Glenmorangie Finalta is the first peated Glenmorangie in many, many years. The recipe is said to be back from 1903, and the Finalta is bottled at 46% ABV. However, the peat does not overwhelm the usual Glenmorangie notes. The nose has muted orange peel, ginger, soy sauce, and nutmeg notes along with the peat. The taste is spicy and complex, with ginger, nutmeg, a touch of salt and soy sauce, and those spices fade to reveal a dry and slightly tart note of orange marmalade. The finish is spicy and long with a touch of charred oak, and I'm scoring the Glenmorangie Finalta a 92. Earlier this week, I opened a sample of Springbank from Chieftains, a 1968 Springbank bottled after 38 years at 43% ABV. The nose, smoky and briny with oak, heather, and honey notes. The taste is intense, peppery, and warming, with notes of smoke, honey, lemon, tea, and a slight citrusy tartness. The finish is tart and smoky with a honey note, long and warming too. I'm scoring it a 93. Finally, I mentioned the Highland Park Orcadian Vintage 1970 bottling a few weeks ago. Got a surprise sample in the mail this week. I was not expecting it. It's bottled at 48% ABV and retails for $3,500 a bottle in duty-free stores. The nose is honey, tropical fruits, light oak, and a touch of campfire smoke. The taste is a complex mix of honey, vanilla, and a spicy cilantro touch. It's nectar thick, along with hints of wood and peat smoke. The finish is well-balanced and long with a touch of honey and soft spices. And I'm scoring the Highland Park 1970 Orcadian Vintage a 95. Just an outstanding whiskey. Of course, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast iPhone app. It's free to download thanks to the folks at the Glenrothes. And you'll find my notes at the WhiskeyCast website, too. That's also where you'll find a link to support the Water of Life Drive, links for my Twitter feed and the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, the updated photo gallery, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. I do love hearing from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.